Good evening and welcome to a discussion on sports and head injuries, where regional experts will answer your questions. Tonight's forum is sponsored by Richmond Magazine and WCVE Public Radio. I'm your host, Craig Carper at WCVE. Our panel of experts tonight include Dr. Robert White of Neurological Associates, team neurologist for the University of Richmond's football team, Marianne Easterling, widow of Atlanta Falcons player Ray Easterling and director of Westminster Academy at Third Presbyterian Church. She and Ray were among seven lead plaintiffs in a federal class action lawsuit against the NFL, contending the league knew that there was a connection between repeated concussions and long-term brain injury, and denied or concealed that connection. We also have Dr. Gregory Oshanek, a Richmond-based neuropsychiatrist and medical director of the Center for Neurorehabilitative Services, who formerly diagnosed Ray Easterling with dementia in early 2011 as a result of concussions he had suffered while playing football. And finally, we have Timothy Swinger, Metropolitan Youth Football League representative on the Verina Athletic Association. My co-host tonight is Tina Eshelman, senior editor of Richmond Magazine, and I will pass it now to her.
Thank you, Craig. The connection between repetitive head trauma and brain dysfunction has begun to get a lot more attention in recent years as a result of studies that have been conducted and news articles about research, as well as the suicides of some prominent NFL players. In September, Richmond Magazine published an article about Ray Easterling, a former Atlanta Falcons player who took his life in April after years of struggling with the effects of head trauma. For our article, the writer, Whit Shepherd, interviewed Ray's widow, Marianne Easterling, who is here with us tonight, along with Dr. Oshanek, a neuropsychiatrist who diagnosed Ray with dementia in 2011. What we're hoping to do at this forum is to try to address some of the questions people have about the risk of sustaining head injuries from playing sports, what can be done to prevent and treat those injuries, and what steps are being taken to ensure the safety of athletes. I'll start with a question from Mrs. Easterling. Given what you know now, can you tell us when you began to notice something wasn't quite right with Ray, and what were some of the early warning signs?
Tina, in 1989, Ray began to have difficulty sleeping at night. He subsequently developed depression that changed his outlook on life and his interaction with me and with his family. He became, in a lot of ways, a different person than the one I had lived with for 13 years. He made some decisions about his personal life and about our life together that were out of character and not at all the way that we had settled on the way we would conduct our affairs as a couple, and became very distant to me as far as our personal relationship. This progressed into combativeness and argumentativeness. Till about 2007, I began to notice disorganization, the inability to follow through on projects, always being late places, not being able to take direction, losing track of time, and those things just continued to get worse and worse as time progressed.
But you didn't know, I guess, what was causing all of that.
I didn't.
And a question for Dr. Oshanek. You diagnosed Ray Easterling with dementia in 2011. Can you tell us how you made the connection between his condition and his football career?
Whenever a patient presents with a constellation or a grouping of symptoms that look to be memory-related, behavior-related, motor skill-related, sensory perception-related, Physicians go through what's called a differential diagnosis, which is taking the person's age, their family history, their medical illnesses in terms of cardiovascular disease, hypertension, sleep apnea, things of that nature. And you go through and do a factor analysis, what's more or less likely. In a situation such as we had with Ray, as we went through those checklists of other things that it could be, everything came back normal or negative. Ultimately, as the possibilities whittled down, we were able to do some additional tests, PET scanning, things of that nature, to look at actually how the brain handles sugar in terms of its metabolism. And in that, we found a pattern that was not characteristic for the typical types of dementias that might be affecting folks in his age group, both in terms of Alzheimer's disease or frontal dementias. And what was consistent was the multiple different areas of injury or areas of decrease that he had. In looking at the pattern of those injuries, looking at Ray's history in terms of football, it became clear that what we were seeing was a dementia that was associated with that.
I guess this is a sort of an open-ended question for our panel. For those listening at home, what are the most important things to remember if you believe you or someone you have observed could be suffering from a concussion?
I'm Dr. Robert White. I think that there has been a common misconception that a concussion equals loss of consciousness. And if you haven't lost consciousness, you have not had a concussion. And I think that's at least the beginnings of the problems. The symptoms of concussion can be so many, just headache, irritability, emotional lability, a little snappy, tearfulness, difficulty concentrating. So I think one of the most challenging issues for coaches and physicians and trainers is recognizing that the symptoms are many, and it's so important to take that very careful inventory of symptoms, not just did you lose consciousness.
I think one of the other things as well relates to the fact that while we're talking about sports and we're talking about blows to the head, that it doesn't require a blow to the head to sustain a traumatic brain injury either, a concussion. That even just the movement of the brain inside the skull in a whiplash format or a shaken baby kind of format can in fact result in those kinds of changes that we see in concussion. And those may, in fact, be the times where it gets even less appreciated in those subtle ways. The major issue is vigilance. The major issue is, as parents or as the adults in charge, to be mindful of what's going on and in a situation that arises that even has the potential, that you don't just dismiss it or ignore it. And you don't have to start wringing your hands and get catastrophic about it, but you don't ignore it and you seek appropriate care and attention.
And for Mr. Swinger, what improvements have been made in recent years in youth athletics, and where is there room still for progress?
I think in youth athletics, I think it's kind of a progression. I think there's a lot of learning that needs to occur, that has occurred and needs to occur. And then I think with the learning, the people who do learn, then in turn they need to teach. You've seen some different programs come out this past year in the Metro Youth Football League. In 2011, we kind of focused on concussion recognition in a coaches clinic, that mandatory coaches clinic that we have every August for all the coaches. In the MYFL system, if you will. This year, we tried to take that to the next step of concussion and spinal cord injury prevention with a presentation that we developed. Within that presentation, we talked about limiting contact in practice, limiting one-on-one drills, eradicating certain drills, the nutcracker drill and things like, and other kind of Stone Age football kinds of drills. We talked about the importance of, if there's any doubt in your mind that the player has a concussion, that they're done for the day. They're, per the MYFL constitution, they're not allowed to play again until they come back with a doctor's excuse, if you will, to play again. So that doesn't mean they necessarily have to have a concussion, but if they're suspected of having a concussion, they still need to have a doctor's release to play again. There's helmet improvements that have occurred. The Virginia Tech's done a study, I think that's been cited many times, where you can purchase helmets that have rated high on that test. There's the NOSCA standard. All the helmets in the MYFL system have to have a NOSCA have the NOSCA standard stamped on it, and it has to be, if it's a refurbished helmet, it has to have a sticker within the last 2 or 3 years or whatever the rule is that we have. Those helmets are all logged in and registered by their serial number every year. So there's, of course, there's a replenishment of helmets that are ongoing. And I think probably most importantly, from my personal view, and I'm certainly not an expert, from my personal view, is the NFL is now involved with USA Football. And in middle of August, they announced a partnership where they are teaching safe tackling techniques, and they will have other coach awareness, coach teaching type tools. And they're also planning on developing a coaching certification test, if you will, that you can use, say the MYFL could use, and have the coaches take that test before they would be certified to even coach within the Metro Youth Football League.
And just to get this on to give people an idea of how large your organization is, I read that there are about 5,000 children in the area who are participating in the league. Is that
Yeah, that sounds
right?
About right. There's 21 to 22 associations. All through Henrico County, up into Hanover, New Kent County, out to Goochland.
And
there's
six teams
within each association for the various age groups, 25 to 30 to 35 kids on a roster, ranging from 5 years old to 14 years old.
All right, and this could be a question for, I guess, whoever wants to answer this. One of the members of the audience said that 35 years ago, his son was had a head injury in a high school football game. And at the sideline, the doctor held up one finger and asked him how many fingers. He answered one, and then they let him back in the game. So his question was, what has changed since then?
Hopefully a lot. One of the things that is recognized in terms of concussion, and it happened pretty much in the mid-1990s, was there was no standardized assessment that could be used at the side of the playing field. At that point, a neurologist very wisely developed with colleagues what was called the SAC, the Standardized Assessment of Concussion. What it looks at specifically isn't the motor symptoms, isn't the visual symptoms. It looks at two elements, your short-term memory and your attention and concentration, as two critical issues that are disrupted fundamentally in even mild concussions. And so by trying to remember a word list and repeat it after a five-minute period, by being able to either recite a string of numbers in reverse or the months of the year in reverse, this provided more detailed information. That's kind of become more sophisticated as time goes on, because we found that individuals would memorize those numbers and memorize the months in reverse, and so alternative forms have developed. So it's one of the things that we hope now that the trainers are using on a more consistent basis in terms of looking at that.
I'd like to know how the risks vary from youth teams to the professional level.
I think it's really hard to quantitate that. I think that the biggest concern at the youth level is the immaturity of their brain. And the youth brain is far more susceptible to injury. Some people theorize because nerve cells have a insulation around them called myelin, and it's sort of like the insulation around a wire. And the youth brain, the myelin is not as mature, and the axons are not as well myelinated, thinking being that that brain, therefore, is more susceptible to injury. The difference is, as they get older, of course, is the force of the impact. And I think that makes a very big difference.
And in terms of youth, we know that, as opposed to what was dogma when I was in medical school 30-plus years ago, that kids rebound faster, we know that that's not the case. We know that if you damage a child's brain, you're basically damaging the foundation that other subsequent developmental stages rely upon. And if you build a house on a shaky foundation, the house is going to be shaky later on. So it becomes even more critical. I think the other thing to look at, to some degree, that counters some of that is the exposure rates. And, you know, when you're a kid in school, be it elementary school, middle school, or high school, your primary job is being a kid in school. And so the coaching and the practices and things of that nature pretty much fall into a season. And you may play multiple sports over the seasons, but it's kind of distributed out. Once you get to college, and certainly when you get into professional sports, at that point, that's your full-time job. And so the exposure becomes greater. It becomes your not just a 40-hour-a-week job during football season. It becomes your 12-month job. And athletes are coming into it healthier, stronger, faster, so that they are working and perfecting their skills and perfecting their bodies all through the year, so that by the time that time comes, the exposure rates are far greater.
And we have a question here from our audience. What is a safe tackle? Is there a way to teach tackling so that the head won't be so involved?
Yes, there's actually it's basically heads-up tackling. Are the programs, and there's a couple different programs out there. The one program is sponsored by the Youth Football Coaches Association, and it's a DVD that's been developed by a former professional football coach and an NCAA football coach, and also the techniques are very much the same that the NFL is endorsing through USA Football. But essentially what it is it's kind of a 4-to-5-step process. So what the player does is the player kind of drops down into the breakdown position, knees bent, back straight up, butt basically out, head up. And then the player is taught to engage the ball carrier with the head and chest out, and then the arms underneath. The armpits are to the side of the running back. And then they're taught to drive with the legs and wrestle the player to the ground. And the whole idea is to keep the chest out and the head back and away from the ball carrier. And there's a number of the one video has almost 30-some-odd drills to practice this without direct contact. And if you look at the two techniques between the Youth Football Coaches Association and USA Football, again, endorsed by the NFL, it's essentially the same thing. And they have names for all the drills and all the different positions. Primarily what you see in youth football relative to the NFL is generally, at least from, say, the 11-year-olds and below, you don't necessarily see violent hits. What you see are head injuries due to poor tackling technique. Players tend to drop their heads. It's kind of a defensive mechanism. The runner will come through the line. They'll see somebody approach, and instead of, say, dropping a shoulder and keeping their head up, they'll just drop their head straight down. And the tacklers tend to do the same things. So what these programs are basically heads-up football. It's very descriptive. It makes a lot of sense. And you tackle with your arms and your shoulder as opposed to your head. And they really discourage diving for the legs. You actually do see a lot of injuries, including spinal cord injuries, where players try to dive at the legs, and they may catch the running back's thigh, will catch the helmet, and that's maybe, arguably, maybe even more impactful than a helmet-to-helmet kind of hit, depending on the size of the ball carrier. So there's a lot of it's generally the same technique, and I guess there's a lot of different ways to teach it, but they all are endorsing the same kind of techniques at the youth level.
For those of us listening at home who may be just joining us, you're listening to a panel discussion on sports and head injuries. My co-host tonight is Tina Eshelman of Richmond Magazine.
And I guess the next question I have is, we've been reading a lot about changing protocol, I guess, for treatment of or handling of someone who's had a concussion. And it used to be people would get up and start playing again right away. And now we're seeing that there's a recommendation of longer period of rest, perhaps no school, no video games, things like that. Could anyone speak to that?
There used to be a grading scale for concussions, a grade one, a grade two, and a grade three. And the system used to be that a grade one concussion, the individual was asymptomatic within 15 minutes. And a grade one concussion could go back to play. So I think one of the first beneficial things is getting rid of that system. Concussion is a concussion is a concussion. And granted, a loss of consciousness carries more gravity, but a player is concussed, they're out of the game. And as Dr. Oshanek was saying, we have a number of tools. There's another tool called the SCAT-2, which is an evolution to keep players from cheating the system. And so we do very rigorous sideline testing. And if we determine, yes, the player has had a concussion, they're out for that game, then they have to be asymptomatic before they can even begin any sort of reconditioning. And the way we determine that is in two ways. One is something called a symptom score. We have, I believe, it's 22 items of symptoms, and they rate themselves each day. At the University of Richmond, we also use a program called the IMPACT, which is an evaluation tool where before the season begins, it's neuropsychological testing of auditory memory, visual memory, speed of processing. And we do that before the season so that when the athlete says, yes, coach, I'm ready to play, that doesn't quite get it. They have to be back to their baseline score before they're ready to play. And so we have a protocol where they have to rest. Many times we work with their teachers to give them some slack in terms of assignments. And then once they're asymptomatic, first day after that, they may just ride the stationary bicycle. And each day there's a bit more vigorous physical activity until they're returned to normal.
I think that sort of answers one of the questions from our audience, which was about how important is it a progressive increase in exercise and assessment to return to play decisions.
Yeah. And if they get to, say, step two and their headaches come back or their symptoms, whatever they were, come back, they have to start all over again.
Tina, your point's well taken, though, that it's not just in the classroom issues, it's also home issues. So during this recovery phase, you know, you want to keep the individual out of harm's way in terms of other types of contact sports, riding their skateboard, riding their bikes, things of that nature. You also want to eliminate from them all of the types of visual things that most of our kids do. Video games, watching excessive amounts of TV, texting, all of those things that involve a lot of precise eye movements, eye-hand coordination issues to allow the brain a chance to rest. They've done studies using PET scans where it measures the metabolism of the brain after a concussion. And in individuals who were not unconscious but merely dazed and confused after a football impact injury, it takes 30 days for the metabolism of the brain to go back to normal. And so there is clearly a period that there is an increased vulnerability That we have to be aware of. And the serial testing that Dr. White was talking about is absolutely, you know, kind of the standard of care and the standard protocol.
I have a general question here, and that is, there's a new Virginia state law that requires the State Board of Education to have guidelines on how public schools handle student-athlete concussions sustained during school-sponsored activities. However, this law does not require local school divisions to report concussion statistics to the state. Does this law go far enough? And if not, what other changes could be made to protect young athletes?
I'll wade in. I don't think it goes far enough. I think there needs to be a reporting requirement. Number one, to really know what this epidemic is about. It's important to have that information. It also will then identify those areas, those coaches, those sports, et cetera, within the Commonwealth, where you have a higher than normal frequency of these things occurring and should ring, you know, ring the bell and ring an alarm for somebody that there's some sort of remedial work that needs to be done there. So while it's great to provide the education and to, but I really think there needs to be a reporting mechanism.
And we have a question from one of our audience. Should high school players or college or NFL players be sidelined for the season after a given number of head hits per season? Is there a magic number here?
There's no data that I'm aware of that says how many concussions you're allowed in a given season. A lot of times there's intuitive feel on the part of the physician evaluating that patient, but as best I know, there are no guidelines that say it, on concussion number three, because the same question also arises, three concussions in a season, how does that relate to one concussion three seasons in a row? We just don't have that information yet. And I think that does get back to the value of a rigorous reporting system that will allow us to look at those issues.
I think one also needs to look at the variety of symptoms that can happen. So not only do you look at cognitive symptoms, problems with short-term memory, problems with speed of processing, problems with multitasking, but you need to look at physical issues as well, subtle issues, such as what's their balance? Because we know that a disproportionate number of people will still have problems with balance even after they go back into the playing field. And that increases their vulnerability because they can't protect themselves as readily in terms of subsequence. So the physician or the clinician involved in the assessment needs to not just limit it to the cognitive issues, needs to relate to sensory issues, auditory processing, visual processing, balance, change in other types of behavioral issues, in persistent irritability, persistent sleep issues and moodiness. Those types of things need to be factored in. Coaches may, in fact, like it if their players are a little more aggressive, but you got to watch because disinhibition and increased aggression can also be a sign of frontal lobe change with concussion, and you're not doing anybody any favors by putting them back in if they're displaying that.
Another audience question. Someone wrote, much evidence shows that repeated subconcussive hits, like those suffered by linemen on almost every play, can be more damaging long-term than isolated high-speed collisions that the NFL and other leagues try to prevent. Given that the fundamental nature of football requires these subconcussive hits, what strategies could leagues institute to make the game safer? Anyone want to take that one?
I think... That is what I read. Again, I'm not an expert, but I certainly have read about that. And I think that's why you see the limiting contact during practice is step one. You're not really going to be able to limit it during a game, right? But you certainly can limit those kinds of hits blow after blow during practices. And you're going to spend more time at practice than you are during a game. You look at a game that is anywhere from a youth football game's 32 32 minutes of game time, of which a player is actually playing probably 10 to 15 minutes of that time. But during practice, there's three practices a week, three nights a week, 2 hours of practice or so, an hour and a half, and they're constantly scrimmaging and in drills and whatnot. So I think to get at that problem, you need to limit contact during practice, or I should say practice during, or contact during practice needs to be limited somehow. And it goes back to the types of drills that are being run also. And the space between players during those drills also, between the two players that are going to be involved in the contact, to try to limit it. You can use quick whistles during scrimmages in practice also. That's done often, where the running back is very rarely actually brought down. As soon as they're made contact, the whistle blows and everybody's done, because you're really focusing on execution and are you blocking the right person, not so much did you block the person out of the way. You want to make sure everyone knows their assignments. Those kinds of techniques can be effective.
Actually, there was a study just published last month in the journal Neurology, where they looked at causes of death in football, professional football players from, I believe it was 1959 to 1988. And interestingly, there was a higher death rate in what they called speed players. The running backs, the safeties, the wide receivers, than in the non-speed players, the linemen. So it may not be that the repeated subconcussive injuries, they may not be quite as bad as what the speed players experience.
I would maybe temper that a little bit as follows. If we're talking about a little league pitcher, we put a pitch count in terms of their less developed arm so that they don't sustain any kind of joint damage. Sports Legacy Institute, who is an organization in Boston, has come up with a concept of doing a hit count so that kids, when their brains are developing, when they are more vulnerable to the effects of either concussive or subconcussive, even though we may not have data, there's a fair amount of just common sense and watching over time, that you set a hit count for each player each week. And when the player hits that hit count, whether it's through practices or whether it's on the field or whatever, that's it for their exposure, that they then have to be sidelined. There's a lot of debate about where that hit count gets set. There's a lot of debate in terms of ages and changing that over time. But it certainly seems, just on face value, if we do that to protect somebody's elbow, why wouldn't we do that to protect their head?
Interestingly, I just heard a few weeks ago there's a company that has a prototype out now of a device that's put in the helmet, and it measures force as well as torque for each hit and records all that. And again, there's no lying there about how hard you got hit. So it'll be interesting to see how that might be incorporated into the youth as well as the professional athlete.
Going back to the last question I asked, could you clarify what subconcussive means?
Subconcussive means that basically if you look at kind of the amount of energy it takes to render somebody dazed, disoriented, or confused, either by a direct blow or by the acceleration or the whiplash kind of effect. These are individuals who experience force, but yet they don't experience that same type of change in their mentation. So the assumption is that it hasn't reached the threshold with that single event to create a cognitive change that can be seen externally, but the accumulation of that is something that can build up over time.
And a question from our audience. After a person sustains a head injury, are there any successful methods to restoring any lost cognitive ability?
Short answer is yes. First off, you have to make sure that the individual is sleeping well. You have to make sure that they are getting some sort of consistent exercise. You have to make sure that they're staying well hydrated. You have to make sure that from a nutritional standpoint, they're eating healthily and they're not overdoing it on caffeine and sugar and things of that nature. So you want the basic four corners to be stable. Then the next thing that you can do is there are a series of cognitive remediation exercises. There's controversy, mostly from insurance companies because they don't like to fund them. There is clear clinical evidence in excess of 700 peer-reviewed articles that have looked at the benefit of doing cognitive remediation for individuals with neurologic change with cognitive difficulties. It's not one size fits all. It's not that anybody can plug in and everybody needs to be involved for, 30 weeks, or some people can't, some people are better after 2 or 3 or 4 weeks. But it certainly is something that is available to people in terms of improving.
And we talk about this in our elderly population, those who don't have Alzheimer's, but where we emphasize to them that we're sure their physicians have talked to them about exercising, about walking, but how many people are told about exercising their brain? And that's something we spend a fair amount of time in our older population. And I think it just follows the same sort of rationale, that there are things you can do to exercise your brain to promote good intellectual health.
I have a question, I guess, for Dr. Oshanek. Ray Easterling was among the players who suffered from CTE. Could you talk a little bit about what that is, and is there any way to determine the likelihood of developing that condition?
CTE stands for chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and because it's such a mouthful, it's a lot easier just to say CTE. CTE is seen as the result of concussive injury to the brain that, in essence, creates a situation where brain cells can't eliminate byproducts of its own activity. So the metabolism, the waste products, if you will, tend to, if you will, sludge up in the cells. While it's seen and described primarily in professional athletes, first in things like dementia pugilistica or punch drunk syndrome of boxers, and seen in NFL players and hockey players, etc., the scary part is that studies have also shown it in high school kids who have died for other reasons that have played contact sports. And early signs of this abnormality, it's called a tau protein, T-A-U, have been found in the temporal regions and frontal regions of their brains, which is pretty scary for those of us who have kids that are playing. But certainly it differs from Alzheimer's type dementia in terms of the type of proteins, the type of sludging that occurs in those situations.
We have another audience question here. Do you think young children under 14 should play contact sports like football?
That's an interesting question because my son plays, and I think that's why this has kind of become my, I've become a flag bearer, I guess, for the safe tackling techniques, because from my view, I think football is a fantastic sport in terms of what it can teach you about team play and about dedication and focus and competitiveness and things that you can carry forward in your life. I think those are great lessons. I think it's better to play something live than it is to play it on the Xbox or whatever. So I strongly endorse that. So then the next step for me is well, how do you make it safer for your son, right, instead of sitting in the background and talking about it or worrying about it? And for me, that was trying to understand more about these things that the good doctors are talking about in great detail. I think if you Google head injuries and concussions, you get thousands of responses. There are articles in the New York Times about it, the end of football and things like that. But I do believe from the articles that I've read about safe tackling techniques, there needs to be a cultural change in football. The old ways that it was played has to change. I think it is an important step for the NFL to get involved at the youth level. I've heard NFL coaches or former coaches, Herm Edwards to be specific, who is on ESPN and was an NFL player and coach for a number of years and a very articulate, very bright person, talk about that it needs to start at the youth program levels. So while it is definitely a dangerous game and it's a sport that's not for everybody, I truly believe that if the powers that be that are involved with it endorse things like safe tackling techniques, you have quick whistles, you penalize players for diving on the piles when the runner's 3 inches off the ground, there's no need to do that. I think if they look at the rules, conferences in the NCAA are moving the kickoffs 5 yards up again. They had been moving them back. Now they're moving them up, so there are more touchbacks and not returns. There are safe ways to play the game if it's taught properly at beginning at the youth levels and starting with the cultures of the coaches involved. Because the coaches, at the end of the day, there's athletic directors, there's people like me around the fringes, there's doctors and all, but it's really the coaches who are with the kids 3 nights a week, 2 hours a night, 2 hours on game day. I mean, they're the ones that are the biggest influencers. So you have to educate those guys.
I would agree with that, but I would say the more important thing is the parent. Because it's not just a factor of what happens on the field. You can have coaches doing everything right on the field, but if the parent lets their kids ride around on their bicycles without helmets, lets them, you know, kind of skateboard without helmets, things of that nature, and increases their risk in that way, kids may have concussions or sustained blows to the head off field that end up being blamed on the field to the football issue. So it needs to be the parents. I mean, as parents, I've got 5 kids. As parents, we're responsible 24/7, 52, to make sure that there is that awareness. And so that becomes the issue, I think, as much as the sports and the coaches, et cetera, the people that are volunteering. It's not always appreciated when parents are kind of called on the carpet. One of the things, policies that I have when I see a new patient is, you know, talking to parents, if you're not going to enforce, and maybe this is shaky ethics, but if you're not going to enforce being this child wearing helmets for things, or if the child themselves is not going to be willing to do that, I'll get them through this episode, but I will not treat them thereafter. Because unless you're doing your part in taking personal responsibility, it makes no sense to reinforce bad behavior.
I'd just like to add, first I'd like to say I don't have the answer to that question. The second thing I'd like to say is I wonder if there isn't a place for youth football to be weight-based, like wrestling, rather than age-based. Because you see 12-year-olds who are bruisers and you see 12-year-olds who are tiny. And to put them on the same field in the same play, it makes you wonder. The second thing is, we were talking one day about college coaches and their longevity in their position, and someone said, how would you like your job to be based upon 19-year-old males doing what you tell them? It's a scary thought. So while I think teaching young folks how to tackle correctly, the fact that they're young says they're not going to do it all the time. And all it takes is that one mistake to have a catastrophic outcome. So I don't know the answer to the question, but I certainly have some concerns.
For those of us just joining us at home, you're listening to a panel discussion on sports head injuries. My co-host tonight is Tina Eshelman of Richmond Magazine, and I'm Craig Carper.
And I would like to ask Mary Ann Easterling a question. And you're continuing to pursue legal remedies against the NFL. You and Ray are part of the class action suit, or
yes,
what are the lead plaintiffs. So I just wanted to ask you a little bit about that and what you hope will be the result.
My main goal, and all of our goals are for the NFL to provide screening for the players who have played the game who come up with the kind of symptoms that Ray displayed, or worse. You know, there are some players younger than Ray who have displayed psychotic episodes. They've serious things where you really can't get help from the NFL and you can't get help from the NFLPA. And our goal is to have the screening available. You know, just at the very base level, when Ray and I went to see Dr. Oshanik, we couldn't afford to go there and got help from our church to go there. So it's really sad that there are, and one of the symptoms of the disease, of CTE, is that the player terribly mismanages finances so that you can be without health insurance, you can be without, you know, you can could have made a decent salary, and yet it's all gone, which was our case. So the player comes up with the disease and has no way of getting diagnosed, and second of all, getting remedies to help stave off the disease in plenty of time. And if the NFL institutes the protocol to be able to do this, then the players would have a baseline MRI where they would be able to see changes in the brain when they happen during football, and then when they happen, you know, when the changes in behavior start happening, and it would protect everybody. It would protect them, and it would protect the players.
I'd like to attempt to summarize several of the audience questions tonight. Can you address the pressure, either from coaches or self-imposed pressure, not to report a suspected head injury? How can this be overcome?
That can be a big problem. At the University of Richmond, I can honestly say that the coaching staff in all the sports has been very proactive. I have never gotten a phone call from a coach complaining why I haven't let a player return to play. I think sometimes a bigger problem, at least at perhaps not at the professional level, but at lower levels, is the self-imposed pressure on the part of the athlete not to admit to, I have a headache, I feel dizzy, I just don't feel right, either because of peer pressure or because of the fear of not being able to play. And that's really the crux of it. If you can't extract from the athlete symptoms, you can't, unless it's blatant, you can't diagnose the concussion.
I think that's exactly right, because the it's a disincentive to give up your position. There are some things that we do. I mean, you mentioned using exercise, because with exercise, many times somebody who doesn't have symptoms will become more symptomatic. Certainly with the accelerometer devices placed in helmets, as they're using at Virginia Tech and other universities, you can watch what the threshold is, and when an impact gets to a certain level, you can then be more proactive in terms of, as a team physician, as a trainer, kind of going and assessing that. Lastly, the ideal would be to have some sort of easy biologic test that could be done at the side of the field. And the military, unfortunately, because of the experience with IEDs and explosions with our soldiers, has been really pushing forward, looking for blood tests that can be done, that can be monitored and measured to see if there are abnormal proteins that would signify brain tissue injury that could be then used. That's the holy grail. It's not quite ready for prime time, but perhaps in the next decade or so, we will have those kinds of instruments to allow us.
One of the things we heard about earlier was the value of sports for young people in terms of teaching about team. And we had after one of the games this year, we had a player come up and say one of his teammates didn't seem to be acting quite right. Would you please check him? And that's what team is about.
Yeah.
One of the audience members also asked, had asked about, I guess, a family member who suffered a concussion in a football game that resulted in memory loss and concentration issues, and said that they were getting some conflicting information from the emergency room physicians and I guess another doctor who was treating him. Do you feel like, I think Dr. Oshanek mentioned when we were talking before the forum that a lot of times emergency room is more focused on the immediate, like broken bones or something like that. But is that something that they're looking at? Do you know?
Concussions, mild traumatic brain injury, generally doesn't kill you acutely. Emergency rooms are designed to deal with those life-threatening emergencies and then to triage everything else. Just because you're discharged from an emergency room doesn't mean you're home clear. And in fact, there's very well-designed studies and well-designed research that says that if individuals present to the emergency room with symptoms of concussion that are do not include loss of consciousness, but merely is the fact that they are dazed, disoriented, or confused as a consequence of the impact, that ER physicians only document that diagnosis of concussion 27% of the time. So that means, you know, 3 out of 4 kids or adults coming through don't get seen. And it in part comes back to an archaic understanding of traumatic brain injury and concussions. It in part goes back to the lack of recognition that you need to look at short-term memory and attention and concentration. And in part, it comes back to the fact that that takes time. Doing those kinds of assessments, you can't just do in a 5-minute encounter. If you're going to be checking somebody's memory over a 5-minute period or 10-minute period, it requires that you're at least there with them face-to-face for 5 or 10 minutes. And many times ERs are turning things over much more rapidly than that.
I have a general question here for doctors that, you know, our primary focus tonight has been on football, but are there other sports, common sports injuries that you see on a, be it soccer or hockey, on a regular basis that better practices could be implemented in to combat these? And by the same token, any areas outside of sports that you see frequent injuries that you think better practices could be put in place?
I see just as many women soccer players as I do the football players. And most of those injuries are from elbows to the head or two women going up to head the ball and they miss the ball and they hit each other. And again, it almost parallels the lesson of football. You can tell athletes how to tackle. You can tell athletes how to head. But in the heat of competition, sometimes that happens and sometimes that doesn't.
I think soccer is a good example. Women's field hockey is another outstanding example. Cheerleading is another outstanding example. I've yet to see any player that's played golf or tennis, but not that I'm endorsing those sports necessarily. But clearly, female injuries are things that generally are underreported in terms of things. It's not really considered in terms of the kind of guidelines or coaching or supervision for those clubs, whatever, as it would be for the male sports.
And one other question from our audience. One member of the audience had said that his fiance was in an auto accident, I guess almost 2 years ago. The car was hit from behind while she was stopped at a traffic light, and she's had multiple MRIs and CAT scans, which apparently indicated a mild concussion. And although she was in very good health before this happened, she's had severe head pain almost daily since the accident. Wants to know, is that normal? And how can... what kind of treatment might be available? Says one recent diagnosis said she might have brain or nerve damage. what options are there to find out what's going on?
I think Dr. O'Shannock and I can both answer this. First of all, it's important to point out that CAT scans and MRIs don't diagnose concussions. Concussion is a clinical diagnosis. The MRIs and CAT scans of people with concussions are normal. So the concussion is a historical diagnosis. It's not from an MRI or a CAT scan. Second of all, is it normal? No. Is it common? Yes. I think we see a lot of patients who have been in motor vehicle accidents that are relatively mild. I mean, we're not talking about helicopter rides to VCU. We're talking about broken windshields and people walking away from the accident, but subsequent to that go through pure misery for sometimes up to a year. And those are difficult patients to manage. There are medications that we use sometimes, and there's therapies that I think Dr. O'Shannock can talk about, but it's not normal, but not rare.
One of the other issues is we need, as physicians and consumers, to think that headache means the same thing in every patient. There can literally be 4 dozen different causes for headaches that occur after a traumatic brain injury, a concussion, motor vehicle, many of which don't relate at all to things going on inside the brain, but relate more to musculoskeletal issues, nerves being pinched, things of that nature that occur, and jaw misalignment, things of that nature that don't generally kind of get looked at or assessed. It can also relate to subtle things like sensory change. So if your eyes aren't working and processing the signal and aren't working in parallel, then you're going to have a syndrome in terms of eye pain that relates when you're trying to scan and read. So there's lots of different causes, and all of those need to be factored through. And again, those types of inquiries take time. They take the ability to give a little more detailed history and ask questions, because fundamental problem with folks who have had concussions is they don't remember. And so if you ask them, do you have this, many times you may not get that answer, or they're not sure if they have it. So it's always important, and one of the take-home points that I would say is it's always important that when you go to a physician talking about concussions, talking about things with your loved one, take a family member, take a collateral informant that can give information, that can give their observations in terms of what's going on.
With that, we are out of time. I'd like to thank our panelists once again for their time and insight this evening, Dr. Bob White, Mary Ann Easterling, Dr. Greg O'Shannock, and Timothy Swinger. Thank you all once again. I'd also like to thank my co-host, Tina Eshelman, with Richmond Magazine. I'm Craig Carper with WCVE Public Radio. Good night.